It's the wired.co.uk podcast, episode 115 for Friday the 15th of March, 2013. This week, we find out what juicy secrets your Facebook likes reveal about you, why the Ukraine's military dolphins went AWOL, and we'll hear from Bill Gates talking about the shortcomings of capitalism. We'll also find out about the Galaxy S4 launch, and an Indiegogo project that is asking tourists to give up a kilogram of their baggage allowance to take resources to the developing world. All that and more coming up as we strap on our backpack for a hike around the rainforest of Wired News. Hello, I'm Olivia Solon and I'm the Associate Editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me is Junior Staff Writer Ian Steadman.
Good afternoon, or morning, wherever you are.
And David Cornish.
Hello.
Hello. So again, we've got no Nate this week. He's back in New York City for the Galaxy S4 launch, and we'll be hearing a report from him later. Last time he went for the PS4 launch,
yeah,
and didn't actually
get
see
to
anything.
See any. He got a controller. We saw that,
yes,
with his,
yeah,
little touchpad. That
not
was...
calling it a launch is a little bit unfair.
It was more
it?
A list.
A list of what's going to happen at the,
yeah,
actual launch.
Yeah.
Pre-launch.
It's like going to the zoo but only getting a list of the animals that were there.
Yes.
Exactly. Well, hopefully he'll see the actual S4. It'd be massively disappointed if he didn't. And also wanted to quickly mention the demise of the Google Reader RSS feed reader.
I'm so upset about this. I can't even tell
Google,
you.
Google, if you don't know, is closing down Google Reader, the RSS feed reader, and it's July, I think. It's going to just,
yep,
fold it.
Got 3 months to get your house in order.
Yeah, there are alternatives.
It's amazing. They all appeared to crash last night as everyone in the world who uses Google Reader was kind of spreading around the web looking for replacements.
Desperate. Well, we'll have a small moment of mourning for Google Reader before we move on to our news. Now, David, liking curly fries on Facebook might mean something about your IQ. Is that right?
It might, yes. This is some research that Cambridge University did along with Microsoft. As you know, Facebook users can hide much of their personal data on the site behind privacy options, which often get criticised, and this new research might actually bring the criticisms back again with rage. Essentially, when users like data, this study has shown that those likes can actually reveal information about your race, your age, your IQ, and even sexuality and other data that you thought you had kept private.
Okay.
So what the researchers did, the like data is actually publicly available by default. So the researchers took a data set of 58,000 US Facebookers, and they were able to grab this data, put it through a psychometric research algorithm that they'd got, and they were actually able to return some surprisingly accurate details just based on what these users liked and what they'd actually clicked on by way of liking it. So some of the stuff that they'd worked out, I mean, they were able to see the really obvious stuff, like so political leanings you can,
yeah,
get from just like what political groups you've clicked like on. They were also able to return a 95% success rate in separating African Americans from Caucasian Americans. There was an 88% accuracy for working out male sexuality, an 82% for determining whether someone was either a Muslim or a Christian. And they were also able to get slightly less accurate results, but for things still like relationship status and substance abuse. So these were bits of information all just based on what you had liked.
And they found a correlation between people who liked curly fries and people who
and
had a high
IQ level. Yeah, how that kind of a thing comes in, I've got no idea. But yeah, that algorithm was able to determine things like that as well. But so yeah, this just raises the question again of what information really is private from groups like Facebook. Although you think you've got a lot of your information hidden.
Yeah. If you supplement it with additional analysis, you can kind of find out more about that person.
Precisely. So maybe should like information actually be kept private? Should marketing groups not have access to that information as well?
I mean, I like the most ridiculous things that have zero bearing on, yep, my interests. I almost do it to kind of troll Facebook a little bit sometimes.
Yeah.
I like things in order to be able to enter competitions, which,
yeah,
I otherwise might not have done. So there's a theatre show coming up at the moment.
Exactly.
I don't really want to like the group. I don't,
yeah,
want people
I only
to
have
think
about
I've got
five
that
likes on it, and three of those friends' bands. I mean, it's just,
yeah,
you kind of do it because people ask you to. But
exactly.
I mean, I always find this quite skeptical. I quite like the Daily Mash's story about this, where the headline was just Facebook likes reveal what users like,
yeah,
which is kind of true.
Yeah. Well, Anyway, if you're worried about it, don't like stuff. Now, not in life, just generally on Facebook.
Don't share it.
Now, if you were a military dolphin, you might not like work and you might prefer chasing the ladies. You might say like to that. Ian.
Can you put this all together into something that makes sense?
Did that not make any sense?
No, well.
Yes, apparently there are killer and horny dolphins on the loose in the Black Sea. Just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water.
Why is this?
This is the Ukrainian Navy, who, like a lot of navies around the world, they train dolphins for various tasks. Because dolphins are very intelligent. They can do really cool things. Like they can find mines and they can find enemy divers before they sort of plant mines on your ship and stuff, and they can either sort of ensnare them in nets or they can alert humans to their presence or whatever. But apparently the Ukrainian Navy has been training these dolphins to kill.
Think Flipper meets G.I. Joe.
It's such a ludicrous idea, the fact that this even... I mean, it's laser beams on freaking sharks.
Exactly. Well, not quite laser beams, but, okay. I mean, pistols, apparently, or knives.
Okay.
So you can imagine you're kind of on a nice sort of Black Sea resort on the beach, having a nice little swim, and then you hear a... bang, and you turn around, even shot in the back by a dolphin. But yeah, these apparently, five of these dolphins went out on a training mission in Sevastopol.
Okay.
Earlier this month, only two of them returned.
And that was because they were horny?
That is the suspicion. A former Soviet naval anti-sabotage officer called Yuri Plyachenko has been quoted as saying that control over dolphins is quite common in the 80s, but if a male dolphin saw a female dolphin during the mating season, then he would immediately set off after her.
It's the dolphin equivalent of shore leave. These poor guys, they just need some R&R.
You wonder if... I don't know if you can castrate a dolphin. Is that not... Is that a possible...
I've never looked into it.
They are... mammals, I assume you can.
I wonder how. Well, I guess that might prevent them from chasing.
Would you want to chasing tail? No, there's no. Oh.
No, Flipper.
Flipper. Yes, but apparently, usually in the 80s, they would come back within a week, so they expect them to come back. But still, if you're in the Black Sea,
there are some armed dolphins.
There are some armed horny dolphins swimming around,
trained to attack,
trained to kill you.
Wow. Well, it's going to be a bit of a challenge to overcome the dolphins' instincts there. And this week, Bill Gates has also been talking about some other big challenges, particularly how to fund research into malaria.
But not fight dolphins.
Not fight dolphins, sadly. But perhaps we should get Bill Gates on this.
Should have asked Bill Gates whether he preferred to fight 100 duck-sized dolphins or one duck-sized
one dolphin-sized duck.
That's it. Dolphin-sized duck.
Yes. I didn't ask that. Bill Gates was speaking at the Royal Academy of Engineering's Global Grand Challenges Summit, and he pointed out that our priorities are slightly tilted by market imperatives, and as such, male baldness research gets much more funding than research into malaria. Now,
why would Mr. Gates care about?
Well, obviously, Bill Gates, perhaps initially known for Microsoft, he's now working. He's got his own the Gates Foundation that prioritizes education programs and combating infectious diseases in the poorest countries.
There's a lot of vaccinations and things, doesn't it?
Exactly. And so he was saying that, you know, because there are these big diseases like malaria that affect people predominantly in poor countries, there are no research budgets that really target these poor people who have these diseases, because they're not going to be able to buy the drugs that the pharmaceutical companies make. So he says that governments and philanthropic organizations such as the Gates Foundation have to step in and offset this flaw in the pure capitalistic approach. And obviously the Gates Foundation is doing this. And he was kind of did a call to action to engineers. He asked them, because it was an audience of engineers, he was asking them to help tackle a number of challenges, such as keeping vaccines cold where there's no electricity. Very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. Killing mosquitoes with lasers, which is something that we had someone speak about at the Wired 2012 conference.
We did, and it was amazing.
And slow-release injectable treatments such as contraception and other kind of TB treatments that could be injected under the skin so people don't have to return to clinics day after day.
But, I mean, is there all of these kind of things, is any of this going to be profitable for people? I mean, is anyone going to want to put money into this?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, someone asked the question, is it possible to have a social business that's also a profitable one? And Gates said that it was possible, but you have to be very creative. And the solution that he found was to build a company that is structured so that it has a product that has value in the rich world and the poorest countries. And so you get your margin from the rich countries and middle income countries, and then you end up having a at-cost business model in developing countries. An alternative is to have a kind of tiered cost system in those developing countries. And he gave a great example in India, where there are eye clinics that charge people who can afford to have treatments like $50, and then the actual treatment costs $20, so they can give other people it for free. So great guy, Bill Gates. And this story is currently storming up the Reddit chart. So people are very angry that he doesn't take male baldness as seriously, because he has all the hair.
Yeah. All the hair. Well, we say that, but he could afford a very nice wig.
Well, that's very true. And also some hair transplant treatment. But anyway, from earthly grand challenges to Martian ones. Now, David, Curiosity has found something exciting on Mars.
Yeah, this is a new story slotting right into our What's Up with Space section. And yeah, news is that there's been analysis of a rock sample collected by NASA's Curiosity rover. And it shows that ancient Mars could have supported living microbes. So essentially what happened is scientists have identified some of the key chemical ingredients for life, like sulfur, nitrogen and hydrogen, all of these in powder Curiosity drilled out of a sedimentary rock near the ancient stream bed it's been cruising around in, the Gale Crater. The data returned by the rover's onboard instruments indicate that the area it's in, the Yellow Knife Bay area, which is on Mars, that the rover's been exploring, has been actually an ancient river system and had been an intermittently wet lake bed that could have provided chemical energy and other favorable conditions for microbes.
So it's a lot of woulda, coulda, shoulda.
Woulda, coulda, shoulda. Basically, yeah, the news, the really important thing to take away is that the rover has found a mixture of oxidized, less oxidized, and even non-oxidized chemicals. And this provides an energy gradient that microbes on Earth can exploit to live. So this energy transfer is able to see microbes sustain life. So in the Mars once upon a time,
yes,
had this kind of environment, it could have supported life for microbes.
But they haven't found life.
It's answered one of the very key questions that Curiosity was sent up there for in the first place, was Mars ever capable of doing this? And it was. They found grey dust up there. So rather than being Mars the red planet, once upon a time it would have been Mars the grey planet.
Yeah.
So now the search will continue for any evidence of those microbes that could have existed within that energy gradient.
That's pretty good going for Curiosity, though. It's only been up there for a few months now, and it's already kind of completed its main mission.
Water
busy,
used to be there.
It
has. So well done to Curiosity. Carry on the good work, little chap.
Yes, well, on that note, I think it's time for us to take an ad break. But when we come back, we're going to hear from Nate, who is in New York.
Wired magazine, now available every month on Amazon Kindle Fire, selected Android tablets, as well as the full range of iPads, from Retina display down to the iPad mini. Don't miss out. Subscribe today at wired.co.uk/magazine.
Welcome back. Now we are going to jet on over to New York, where Nate has been at the launch of the Galaxy S4. Over to you, Nate.
Thanks, Liv. Yes, I am here in the very newest of Yorks, New York City, to be precise. I'm over here for the launch of the Samsung Galaxy S4, which, for the uninitiated, is Samsung's latest and greatest smartphone. This is one of the best-selling smartphone lines in the world, and this is Samsung's next step along that line. So I came over here to take a look at it, and what is pretty obvious at first is that it's going to appeal to anyone who currently has or likes the Galaxy S3. It's a tiny, tiny little bit thinner, but it actually has a bigger screen. So it's now a 5-inch screen, which is a step up from most phones at the moment. You know, most are sort of around the 4-4.5 mark. This has now gone up to 5. And the screen also has a full 1080p display. It's insanely crisp. We've seen a couple of phones recently that have got these extremely high pixel densities. It's something Apple started doing popularizing with the iPhone 4 initially, the Retina display. But now other companies are coming out with much higher pixel densities. So this is a pixel density of 441 pixels per inch, which is about a quarter sharper again than what Apple currently offers, and is significantly higher as well than the Galaxy S3. And what you really feel is that it's a very vibrant, extremely crisp screen. One of the other phones that we'd seen this on actually was the HTC One, which I think you guys talked about on a previous episode when I was away for some other launch, probably in New York for PlayStation. And but the overall feel of the phone is that it's extremely similar. It's going to appeal to people who have got the S3 and really like it. There are a few interesting new features that are worth noting, though. The first is that this is the first phone we've seen that's got an 8-core processor. So we've seen quad-core phones before now, but this now, at least in the UK at least, is going to be 8 cores. There are two variations for some reason. There is a version that overseas markets are going to get, which has a quad core processor running at 1.9 gigahertz, but then the UK version or the European version is 8 cores but running at 1.6 gigahertz. So it's a little bit interesting why they've gone with the two different chips, and I couldn't get a solid answer out of Samsung when I was speaking to some of their company reps over here. But the promise is that the performance is going to be about the same, and certainly when you're using it, it feels exactly like you would want it to use. It's very, very snappy. It's very big, but it doesn't feel too bulky, and as I said already, it's a very, very nice display. A few interesting other points that are worth noting. Samsung has really ramped up what it's trying to do with photography. So there are kind of 6 points that the S4 tries to really increase over the S3, and photography is one of those. One of the most interesting things that they've been able to do is use the front and back cameras simultaneously. So anyone who's listening who has taken a family photo, but one of the families had to stand with the phone and take the picture, and so you're missing from that photograph, this is something that can kind of combat that. So you can take a front-facing photo of yourself while you're taking a photo on the rear camera, and it sort of overlays it in one of various different designs, so you can kind of get a photo with all the family in it, for example. And the same works for video as well. So you could record. In fact, there was a really good suggestion that someone else on when I was over in the press conference suggested, is that it'd be really good for people doing reviews of gadgets at trade shows, because you can record video kind of picture in picture. So for example, you're holding the phone over something you're talking about, and you can also show yourself talking about it, which actually sounds a little bit tedious and boring now I've said it out loud, but it is kind of a neat feature for sharing maybe family video clips and stuff like that. A couple of other things I wanted to highlight. The camera on the front doesn't just take pictures, it's also tracking your eyes. The S3 did it a little bit, but this is now taking it a step further. And one of the most interesting implementations of this is something that Samsung calls smart pause. So if you're watching a video and someone distracts you or asks you a question, rather than having to tap the screen, press pause, simply looking away will pause the video, and looking back will resume playback of the video. And it uses similar technology in the camera to facial recognition. So if you know when you hold a camera up, and it will detect people's faces so you can focus better. It uses that sort of technology to do that. And in my demo, it worked really very well. I couldn't get it to not work when I was testing out, which was quite cool. And you can also use gestures in front of the camera as well. For example, waving your hand left to right over the screen will have the same effect as, say, scrolling back and forth between songs or web pages. It's a little bit like what I suppose Kinect does on the Xbox, that you can wave to gesture in front of the TV, and you can kind of do that with a phone. Probably only useful if maybe you're in a kitchen baking and have stuff all over your hands and you just want to skip songs without putting sticky fingers on a screen. You can also wave at the phone actually, and that will answer incoming calls. Quite neat. There's also an integrated translator, which is not necessarily that innovative in terms of apps. Like, we've seen translation apps where you can type in text or you can speak into a phone and it will translate it and speak it back to you. But Samsung's integrated this translation technology throughout the phone's native apps. So if you're on a website and you want to translate what's on the web page, you can just pull up an option to translate it. It will read it out in one of a number of different languages. You can also speak to the phone in your native language, and it will translate that into about 8 languages, I think, that I saw in my demo, which can then be either input in text or spoken back out. So you could use it as a kind of as a way to have a conversation with someone in a foreign country, for example. There are a few other things. I'm aware I've gone on for quite a bit now. I've got a full hands-on on the website. If you go to wired.co.uk and search for Galaxy S4, you will find my hands-on. You'll also find a post that's got all the specs and things, official pictures, my own hands-on pictures, and a few examples of the camera technology, as well as a general look and feel of the phone itself. Release date, we're looking at Q2. I've heard towards the end of April for the UK, so it's not long to wait. And basically, anyone who's got an S3 right now, probably going to want to check it out. It is a nice piece of kit, and it really does give Apple something, I think, to catch up on. With the what can only be probably the iPhone 5S. Anyway, back to you guys in the studio.
Thanks, Nate. Next up, we're going to look at BitTorrent, which has launched a streaming service.
It has.
Tell us about it, Ian.
Yes. Sorry, jumping in there. It's called BitTorrent Live, and it works the same way as BitTorrent does. Now, BitTorrent launched in 2004 and kind of revolutionized file sharing because it made it possible to download very large files, even with a slow connection, by splitting them up into bits. Obviously, if you don't know how peer-to-peer networking works like this, but and kind of downloading them in a random order. So you'd be downloading off the original person who'd upload the file, but also anyone else who had the next bit you needed around the world. So it created a kind of network of downloading that made downloads very fast. The more people who download, the faster it went.
So what does BitTorrent Live do?
The same thing, but with video streaming, which has been a problem people have been trying to crack for a while because obviously the scalability is quite impressive. The more people who try to access a video, the faster it goes. And it's kind of being targeted at two kinds of people. There's large providers of video, people like YouTube or Netflix, who at the moment have to buy a lot of infrastructure, have to load their videos into a lot of servers so that there's enough bandwidth they can provide enough bandwidth for everyone who wants to watch the videos, watch them. And that's going to be quite attractive to those kind of companies. I mean, also to people who like professional sports broadcasters and stuff, people who are live streaming live events around the world. So that become quite good for them. But it's also being aimed at small broadcasters. So that's like individuals, people like protesters who might at the moment use a service like Ustream to broadcast live from where they are around the world. Problem with that is that it's quite easy to shut down a stream. With this, it's decentralized, so it's hard to shut it down. And it's also, it's going to be faster. So, I mean, this massively lowers the barrier to entry for anyone who wants to launch kind of like a YouTube-style service. All you need is a video and just as, like, you need this technology and you can pretty much stream to as many people as you want.
Okay. So is this a kind of a legitimizing BitTorrent?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that implies that it's illegitimate in a way. It's very useful technology.
Well, no, but I imagine there's a lot of content creators who might perhaps look at BitTorrent as a threat to their business models. But now,
I guess it's coming as economics. It's whether they will save more from adapting this technology than if they'll lose from this potential piracy aspect of it. But it does look like it's going to be quite an interesting thing. You can sign up to at the moment at the BitTorrent Live site if you want to be a broadcaster.
Yeah.
There isn't much up there at the moment because it's just new. And that was kind of, I was trying to click on stuff yesterday that they had channels that were up that you could test. And I think that was kind of the reverse issue there, was that because there weren't many people trying it yet,
it was all
really slow.
Okay.
But the more people who use it, the faster it will get. So it's going to be interesting. So you can still imagine YouTube having to have a lot of servers, but you know.
Build it and they will come.
Exactly. Okay. Well, I think the more people who sign up, the better it's going to get, which is the best thing. So,
okay.
Yeah,
so
give it a try.
Go and give it a try.
Yeah.
Now, our final story is another challenge. We heard Gates talking about tackling diseases affecting the poorest people in the world. But there's a really interesting organisation that's been set up recently called Billion Books Baby, which is inviting tourists to offer up 1 kilogram of their baggage allowance to carry resources such as books, toys, pens, some sort of medical equipment to the developing world. Now, this is a concept that's been developed by a Singularity University student called Alexandru Chelak, and he's currently looking for funding on Indiegogo. And so the idea is that there's 1 billion tourists per year that travel to all these different countries, and they have bags, and that air freight generally is very expensive for NGOs and charities. So if a load of people could give up a small space in their bags, they could shift lots and lots of weight of, you know, resources from rich countries to the poorer countries, and kind of following the sort of peer-to-peer models of things like Airbnb, I guess, and TaskRabbit, where you just need a kind of web network and logistics network to
use lots of individuals to transfer big amounts of things.
Yeah. How expensive is freight at the moment?
Well, I checked out FedEx website, and obviously it's a bit unfair to look at a single kilogram being shipped from the UK, because obviously an NGO wouldn't just ship a single kilogram. But if you do want to do that, to ship it from London to Cambodia, it costs £100 for a single kilo.
Wow, that's a lot.
So it is expensive. And so by giving up this space, if people do indeed have space in their bags, it could really help reduce costs for those organisations. And I just think it's a really great idea.
Yeah.
I mean, the details are incredibly sketchy. It's basically that idea. And the guy hasn't got any kind of actual structure to how he would do this by the sounds of it. So it will be interesting to see how that works. I mean, already it's a bit of a challenge to get anything across borders.
Yeah. And I always find it interesting, this idea that you go to developing countries, you often see them wearing like clothes from 20 years ago, because that's what we give to them. And I'm sure they could probably get clothes there themselves easily, but the medicine's not as much. So this kind of presumably frees up a lot of space for medicines and more essential stuff on, say, Red Cross planes and things.
Exactly. So, and this is not entirely unlike a pilot that was done in Germany, where DHL actually asked members of the public who to kind of map their regular routes and then invite them to carry a parcel along their regular route. So if, you know, I go from London Bridge to Green Park every day, why can't I also carry a small parcel and then I can get rewards for doing that?
Was that successful?
It was a pilot. I don't know whether it was successful or not. It hasn't been rolled out to the UK, I don't think. So.
I imagine the liability issues with people just getting bored halfway through and going, oh, I'll do this tomorrow.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Just opening the parcel halfway and be like, well, this is much better than the reward I was going to get. I'll just take these.
Yeah.
I think you have to have a general trust in mankind in order to have any services functioning. The same could apply for DHL.
In general, yep.
In general. But anyway, but big idea. It's been endorsed by Peter Diamandis, who is the XPRIZE founder, and he bigged it up on the Indiegogo site. But you can go and check it out. Look up Billion Books Baby. And if you like the idea, you can donate money to it. But that's our show for today. David, tell us how people can get in touch with us.
You can follow us on Twitter. We are at Wired UK. We've also got a Facebook page, so head onto Facebook and like us, and some scientists will be able to work out what kind of a person you are. A very intelligent and cool one. And you can also email us on podcast@wired.co.uk.
Thank you very much.
No problem.
Bye.
Bye.
Basically, Curiosity has analysed a rock sample, and it's shown that Mars could have supported life. It could have supported living microbes with it. I'm starting this again because I've ruined the story.